We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Good morning and welcome to the morning briefing for Thursday, January 8th, 2018. I'm your host, Eric Dame. Jake Hughes is your producer. And coming up on today's show, we'll be joined by AMVET's Executive Director and Marine Corps veteran, Joe Schinelli. He'll be calling in from the road where he is to basically attend one of those lovely town hall meetings that the AMVET's organization holds. We're also going to talk to a gentleman from the Naval History Museum at Annapolis. That's right, over at the Naval Academy, about a very interesting recent find. You see, it turned out that that museum actually had some pretty amazing things in their collection that they didn't even know about. Yeah, they went digging for something and found something else. What exactly was it? Well, it has something to do with flags, and we're going to talk to them about that coming up later on in the show today. All that and so much more on today's edition of the Morning Briefing. And now, of course, we welcome Jake Hughes into the studio. Jake, how are you this morning?
I'm doing good. I'm glad you're feeling better.
Yeah, I'm still not great. In fact, it's probably going to be do the show and then head home for me. But yesterday was not good. Woke up at about 3:00 in the morning. Thought I had heartburn. Just felt like really bad heartburn. So went and drank some water. Said, okay, this is feeling, I guess, a little bit better. Went back into bed. The heartburn came back stronger. And then I realized like, oh no, I think I'm going to throw up. And boy, did I for the next 9 hours or so. And didn't leave the bed for over 24 hours. I mean, it was ridiculous. The bedroom was my home yesterday, and just a rough day overall. But what are you going to do? So now, the vomiting and everything else seems to have stopped. So here I am, and we'll see if I can make it through the full hour and a half. I think I can. But yeah, everything feeling a bit better today. Still not great, but good enough to get in here. Of course, yesterday Jake hosted the show, and how was everything yesterday?
Everything went fine. Surprisingly enough, things run smooth when you're not here.
I find that hard to believe, but of course it's true. Today, as I said, we're going to talk to Joe Schinelli about what's going on with AMVETS. He's got a list of items that he wants to talk to us about today, and we're looking forward to that conversation. And then, of course, the museum at Annapolis. They found some pretty cool stuff over there, Jake, that was in their collection, and sometime around, 100 years ago or so, was kind of put away in an odd way that led to them finding it very recently, and now getting ready to put it back up on display. It's a bunch of flags, very interesting flags that they had no idea were in their collection until just a couple of weeks ago, it looks like. So, taking a look at news from around the military. This one came out, I read about it yesterday while I was stuck in my bedroom. I had my phone and would try to keep up on the latest news. The Navy filing homicide charges, yep, against the commanders of the McCain and Fitzgerald, which, it's rare that happens. But in these cases, there were so many mistakes made. Somebody needs to be held accountable. And when you're the commanding officer of a ship, everybody on that ship's life is in your hands. It's your responsibility.
Yeah, like I said yesterday, crap rolls uphill because it can't just be a fault of some sailor that missed the ship or something. This is systemic failures on multiple counts that can only point to bad leadership.
Yeah, well, I don't know. When you talk about a crash, it's what happened that night. You can't say anything leading. I mean, unless they were untrained and there's a lot of things going on with these ship collisions and the responses from people. I've heard someone here was talking about an NPR thing where they said, well, they don't get any sleep. We've never gotten any sleep on ships, and this stuff didn't happen before, so there's something else that's different now. When I hear that, like, oh, they're working, what was I hearing? 60-hour work weeks, 70-hour work weeks. I was like, 70-hour work week, you're at sea, it's 7 days a week, 70 hours is 10 hours a day. That's not that long. That gives you 14 hours of the day to finish everything else you got to do. Laundry, sleep, get any training, whatever else done. I mean, engineers have never gotten any sleep on Navy ships. They average, you know, 2 to 4 hours a day because they don't sleep at night. Typically, they're very different people, those snipes working down in the engine rooms. But I keep hearing some of these things and I look at it and be like, dude, that's it. It's always been like this. So what's different now that's causing these crashes? Is it bad training? And I think that probably has a lot to do with it. I think that they're not I don't know, man. I think that there used to be more repercussions for not doing things the right way. And now in the kinder, gentler Navy, there aren't as many. They're not going to do they're not going to hammer somebody for not getting a qualification done immediately. It's just a personal opinion, but the whole sleep thing, I heard that when it was somebody in here that was talking about the NPR story. Oh, they're working 70-hour weeks. Yeah, 7 days. Yeah, like I think people hear that and they assume the same schedule that you have as a civilian or the same schedule that you have in port or whatever, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. No, when you're out to sea, that ship is out there every day. You're working every day, 7 days a week. A 70-hour work week is actually not bad. Yeah, that's 10 hours a day. That's less than what we would work when we were out to sea.
And more than that, you form to adjust to the mission. Like, I remember there was a point in my first deployment where there was about a month where we were working 24 hours in sector and 12 hours off. Hmm. And that includes maintenance on the tank and every other stuff you have to do.
Yep.
So we didn't get a whole lot of sleep, but you know what? We made it work. And that's what I think is bad, or what really went wrong with this ship, is that if it was sleep, it's, again, failure of leadership.
But if that's always been the way it was, you want to tell me they got more sleep in like World War II? You want to tell me they got more sleep in the 40s, 50s, and 60s? There's no way, but they weren't having these same issues with these collisions. I think they're trying to find something to blame it on, and they're looking at all this stuff. But from what I've heard from a lot of, and again, I spent very little time at sea, 3 out of 13 years on ships, and never did a full deployment on a ship. The longest I was out was like for a month at a time. But from a lot of the sailors I know who that's been their life, is being out to sea, the sleep schedule hasn't changed. Who's in the Navy has changed, I guess. There's different people in now. Maybe some of these youngsters coming in now aren't quite as able to put up with the stresses of the military and the stresses of shipboard life. I've heard a lot of different things from a lot of different people who all have different opinions. And, you know, some of them... It may be the captain's fault, but this also could be just somebody made a stupid mistake and crashed the ship into another one. You could say, well, this was bad leadership. It was this, it was that. Well, it hadn't happened before. If it was that bad leadership and the guys had been commanding officer of the ship for 2 years, then why weren't there any collisions before? It brings up a lot of questions, but in the end, lives were lost, mistakes were made, and the commanding officers of those ships, they're the ones who are going to pay the piper, and they are being charged with homicide, essentially, negligent homicide, and other criminal charges. There's also an unnamed chief petty officer being filed, having some sort of, dereliction of duty charge. So don't know who that is or exactly what it is, but I would guess somebody that was on the bridge on one of those ships. So there's also non-judicial punishment actions being taken against 4 Fitzgerald and 4 McCain sailors, probably the junior guys involved, who, you know, it would be a very bad look, despite the fact that their actions may have directly been the ones that that caused the crash, their actions or inactions. It's a bad look to be going against, you know, Petty Officer Third Class Johnson instead of the commander of the ship.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, crap rolls uphill, because if I had a soldier that got a DUI, they're not going to look too hard at him. They're going to look at me. They'll say, why didn't you teach this soldier not to do that? Why didn't you do your job as a leader here? You failed.
You can say that, but you can also say, what if they did teach him how to do his job and he just didn't do it?
I agree. I agree with that. But I'm saying that's how the military looks at things. Yeah. They try to handle things at the lowest level possible, yes. But at the same time, they look at leadership differently than they do the rabble, the commoners.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Seaman Drifty, that kid out there.
Yeah,
Seaman Drifty is he's the scumbag, basically. Seaman Drifty can't have his uniform right, can't do anything right, but eventually is going to have to be put into some sort of responsible position or kicked out of the military. And it's not that easy for them to kick people out of the military. Look at the story on that Mims kid that we've been talking about, the one who went missing. The one who went missing on board his ship, hiding in a void, which is kind of like just an engineering space where there's nothing in there. That kid should have been removed from the military long before that ever was allowed to take place. So it's very interesting. It'll be interesting to see how the trials go. I imagine this will be covered pretty closely when they actually do go to trial, because for one, they were asleep. I mean, it was after their hours, and they assume that their people are going to be well-trained enough. And then I guess the question is, well, did you train them well enough? It's going to be very hard to prove. I mean, they're going to have to look through training logs. Then that might lead to some other stuff, because if the training logs were ever fudged, if you had like, yeah, we did this training on this day, and then someone testifies saying we didn't do that training ever, how could we have done it on that day? It'll be interesting to see exactly what happens. But those two commanders being charged with that. Seeing another very interesting one, and this comes from our friend that we've had on the show before, Jeff Zizulowitz over at Navy Times, talking about a sailor's suicide attempt that prompted a heroic response by a submarine crew. Crew of the submarine North Dakota is out there charging through bad weather after an unidentified petty officer shot himself in the chest with his military-issued rifle while the vessel was underway.
Wow.
Yeah. Shot himself, and then the sub basically got back as fast as they could to put him back, and it looks like he is going to survive. But think about that. Get issued your weapon. You're on a submarine. That's one place where you don't expect gunfire at any point. And if there is going to be gunfire, it's probably, unfortunately, going to be self-inflicted. But for them to have to charge back and get this person in there, that is not good. So the corpsman got him stabilized. Radio men were able to somehow keep communications open despite the fact that they were in horrible weather. And the commander Mark Robinson, afterwards says, you know, from gunshot to ambulance, it was about 7 hours. We drove up the river in dense fog in the dark of the night with intense rain and wind. Worst weather I've ever seen for something like this. Said he saw tons of heroism over that time. So, yeah, good for them. I mean, that's something you don't think about. A submarine having to get back in. And they're lucky they were within 7 hours, because it usually takes quite a long time for those submarines to get from one place to the other, particularly in bad weather. Underwater, they're quite a bit faster than they are above water, but they're also, they've gotten very fast, but still, I mean, 7 hours, that means that they were fairly close to port. So pretty lucky for them. Then another not nice story coming out of Camp Pendleton. Did you see this one yesterday, Jake? This is about the Marine that was killed at the School of Infantry.
No, what happened?
And another Marine is in custody. You see one Marine killed, another taken into custody. There was a fight at the Camp Pendleton School of Infantry, according to the Marine Corps. And the San Diego Union-Tribune reports that a Marine was fatally stabbed by another Marine during this fight. An NCIS investigation has been opened and is currently ongoing. That's what a Marine Captain Joshua Pena told Marine Corps Times. This is not good, man. Private First Class Ethan A. Barclay Weber Powell, who was assigned to Lima Company Headquarters and Services Battalion at School of Infantry West, was killed in the incident. He was 18 years old and had just entered the Marine Corps in July. So this was out at Camp Pendleton at the School of Infantry. Looks like another Marine in that same unit, they are not releasing the name right now, a fight broke out and there was a stabbing, and it took the life of one Marine. I mean, that's, oh man, there's enough things that the Marine Corps has to deal with just as part of their job, taking on enemy fire, being the first to fight, and then having something like this when you're just in training and it's a Marine taking a knife to another Marine, taking his life. I mean, this is horrifying stuff, really, and not something that we like to see.
And this is going to lead to another investigation of things like, it's probably going to revolve around the recruiting process. Like, should this guy have been screened out? Or did he have a history of violence that the recruiter overlooked? Or something like, maybe did the drill sergeants not do enough to separate the two or whatever? But heads are going to roll.
Mm. Yeah, it's, but again, you don't know. There could be anything. There could be outside things. I remember being in the military, being in the Navy, and seeing two kids at one command in particular who are from Los Angeles. and were both affiliated with different gangs before they came in. And they, as soon as they realized that, they were like, oh boy, you could tell something was going to happen. And eventually it did turn into a pretty big fight. And I believe both of them were kicked out of the Navy. There can be outside influences that have nothing to do with the command. You just don't know. And there's also just crazy people. There's crazy people in all walks of life, including the military.
Well, you're right. But then you got to remember that the military always looks for someone to blame.
Yeah.
That no matter what, like, it's even the same thing with the Fitzgerald. It could be no one's direct fault. Like, it could have been a combination, a cocktail of failure, but someone's got to be blamed. We have to be able to point the finger at someone.
Yeah, I think they have someone. The guy who had the knife in his hand in this case. Unless there's something else that the command knew there was something going on and put the guys together. This doesn't, I don't know if this will end up being any sort of command thing. I mean, this sounds just like a crazy person. Again, who pulls a knife on a fight with another Marine? It just doesn't make any sense to me. But hey, that's probably because I never fought nor killed anybody that I worked with over there. Oddly enough, a U.S. Navy veteran's mother was denied 2 visa requests to attend her son's funeral in Arkansas this past December. You see, this young former sailor, Ngoc Truong, left the Navy at 22 years old in October after serving for 4 years, planning to study graphic design in Florida. Diagnosed shortly after he left with leukemia and died in December. So boy, that's a rough time. October, he gets out. December, he dies. His father is from Vietnam and lives in the States. His ex-wife still lived in Vietnam, and the State Department has not given any explanation as to why right now, but she was denied a visa to come for the funeral. There could be any number of reasons there. But again, we can look at this with the government and the military, public affairs and public relations. Whenever I was in charge of public affairs and public relations at places that I worked at, I was as open as I possibly could be. Nope, not in this case. State Department's like, yeah, we're not going to tell you. We're not going to tell you why. Well, then that just looks bad. It looks like you just don't want a grieving mother to be able to grieve for her son at his funeral, one who just served in the military and got out, 3 months ago and died within 2 months of that. It's just tell us. Tell us what the reason is. If it looks bad for you, guess what? This looks bad for you. Saying that you're not going to tell us, that looks bad. If there's another reason that's bad, like just because, well, we decided that we didn't like her, and there's no good reason. I would imagine that they have a valid reason for this, that you would think, you would hope. But if you don't tell us about it, they said citing legal confidentiality reasons, they would not provide any further explanation. All right, well, you know what? Then you're going to have these stories out there where it's going to be just, they didn't care about, even though her son served in the United States military, they didn't care about this woman because she was a foreigner. And in the current environment where everyone's trying to point fingers and prove who likes who and who hates who and who's this, who's that, who's a racist, who's a nationalist, this is going to add fuel to those flames. Yep. When you don't tell people what the reason is. If you didn't have a valid reason, well, then that's an important thing for us to know. If you did, that's also important. But right now, now you've got things where his father is coming out and saying he's already done for this country, but what has this country done for him? Well, right now, not so much, because they wouldn't let his mother come and attend his funeral. So that's upsetting. And again, this PR stuff where I swear, man, they just put us in charge of public relations for the military, the government, and the State Department. Put me there and make me unfireable by until I do something wrong, and not just, some senator, some secretary saying, oh, no, don't tell them about that. We don't need to tell them about this. Just quiet it up and it'll go away. And I don't think that they understand how it really works, that it's not good.
Yeah, maybe back in the day you could get away with something like that, but in today's day and age with 24-hour news and the internet, no, things don't just go away. They're there forever.
Yeah, and you have plenty of, also in the hyper-specific news world where you have, we always had military times, Navy times, Army times, Marine Corps times. We always had all those things ready to cover the military items and events. Now they're online, and there's a million others as well. There are great ones like us, of course, connectingvets.com, where you should be going every day. Task and Purpose, that's another great. I mean, there are plenty of sites following things just like this. So if they don't, I don't know. If they don't, if they thought they would get away with it because the news cycle would cover it, well, now there's this hyper-specific news focus where you have, you know, you go to Military Times, you go to Connecting Vets, you go to all these sites. That's what they focus on. So they're going to keep, this story is going to last a lot longer on those sites than it is on others. People interested in it are going to go there. It's going to get picked up by, it's the new media environment. You have to understand it. And I don't think that those in charge of public relations and public affairs at the government, specifically in the military, I don't think they get it. Part of that is because a lot of the people, I'll tell you what, man, you go to a lot of the public affairs offices around the country, the big ones within the government, State Department, everywhere else, the people running them, they have been in those types of positions for like 30, 40 years now, and they're still operating as they would have during previous eras, which I don't think you can do right now. So, you know, we'll see exactly what happens with that. Interesting thing from a place that's, I don't know if it's near and dear to my heart, but it's a place that I lived. That is Guam. They are now deploying B-52 bombers to Guam for only the second time in history. So Anderson Air Force Base, there are two military installations on Guam. You have Naval Station Guam, which is in the south, southern part of the island, and then Anderson Air Force Base is way up north on the island. They've recently moved up stealth bombers, B-1s and B-2s, and now the B-52s are joining them there. It's about a week after the B-2 stealth bombers. What's that, the B-52s?
Yeah.
Lobster, Love Shack, all that stuff.
That was a horrible joke. I apologize.
Oh, that was a joke? I thought you were serious. I thought you were just a big fan of, what's that guy's name? Oh, I can't remember his name, the lead singer of the B-52s. His name was like Jim B-52erson or something like that. Anyway, they're from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. There are about 300 airmen going along with them, and they're going to support the U.S. Pacific Command over there, replacing six B-1Bs, the Lancers, that are supposed to go back to South Dakota at the end of this month. So, yeah, what people hear about Guam, or when they hear about Guam, I should say, they often wonder, like, why are we in Guam? Well, the Navy base is forward deployed base for submarines. It's a stopping point occasionally for Navy ships. There are no permanently stationed surface ships in Guam, but we'd have ships come in time to time to the port. But it's mostly a submarine base. Those submarines are keeping an eye on China, North Korea, the Pacific Theater in general. It's kind of what they're doing. And then Anderson Air Force Base allows a staging point for basically quick reaction to anything that happens on the Korean Peninsula, mainland China. B-52 bombers can fly a long, 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 long way. I mean, there was time during the war in Iraq where they were taking off from the United States, going over on bombing runs and flying back to the United States.
Really?
Yeah, with like mid-air refueling and things like that. I don't know how exactly they were doing it, but they can travel a ridiculously long amount of time. It takes a long time, but yeah, they were flying out of like the Dakotas or something and running, doing runs over to Iraq and going back. It's crazy, but it's, you know, they're a necessity when it comes to bombing runs. And now with the B-52s being in Guam, that gives us the opportunity again for quick reactions. If something were to happen on the North Korean side of the Korean Peninsula, then you have these massive bombers that have huge long distance capabilities. They would easily be able to make it up to North Korea and back. I wonder now, see, now I want to look it up. What is the B-52's? B-52, I don't know what the, okay, so it's 159 feet long with a range of 8,800 miles.
Wow.
That's insane. 8,800 miles. How far across is the United States?
I think 3,000, 3,500, something like that.
So it can fly back and forth across the country. Fly it from like the East Coast to the West Coast and back and still have 1,000 miles of fuel left.
Yeah.
That's insanity. They are a pretty impressive thing. 185-foot wingspan, 159 feet long. Been around since 1955 and still has that 9,000-mile range. Whew, that's a long way to fly, man. So I think when you're talking about the ones that were in the Dakotas, I think they were flying west maybe over to Afghanistan and doing stuff there and then flying back to the Dakotas. I mean, it's crazy that they have the ability to do that, but it's pretty awesome that they do. And now they'll be able to do that from Guam, and it's a little bit shorter trip up to the Korean Peninsula. So keep that in mind, Mr. Kim Jong-un. B-52s are there, and we're not talking about the ones who sing Love Shack. We're talking about the ones who rain death and destruction in large quantities. They're very good at that. We're very good at ConnectingVets.com of keeping our finger on the pulse of the military and veteran communities, and that's what we're doing here on The Morning Briefing. I want to remind you to follow us on social media, where we are at Connecting Vets on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and, of course, YouTube. Coming up in just a little bit, we are going to have the executive director of AMVETS, Mr. Joe Schinelli, my former Defense Information School classmate. He's done pretty well for himself, rising to the number one post in the AMVETS organization. He's going to talk to us about everything they've got going on in just a couple minutes. And then later, I'm going to talk to Mr. Claude Berube of the Annapolis Naval History Museum about a recent find that's pretty darn cool that they made. Morning Briefing, back after this.
Helping military veterans stay connected.
We make it easy.
We're CBS Radio's ConnectingVets.com. Connecting Vets every day.
Online and all over social media. Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. At Connecting Vets.
Welcome back to The Morning Briefing for Thursday, January 18th, 2018. I'm your host, Eric Dame. Jake Hughes is your producer on the other side of the glass, and ConnectingVets.com is your website. And we mean that, created by veterans, for veterans, and focusing on the veteran and military experience. ConnectingVets.com is your one-stop shop for all things veteran-related. And the best way to be kept abreast of what we're doing on that website is to follow us on social media. We are at Connecting Vets on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. Little click of your mouse or tap on your phone will change your life for the better, and that's what we are all about. We're also all about bringing you the cool stories from out there, and as those of you who listen to the show regularly know, I'm a big-time history nerd. The books that you got assigned in history class in high school and college that you hated reading, I buy those and read them for fun, because I find that stuff fascinating. And this next story, this is a story that the history nerds are going to geek out about, and even if you're not one, you're going to like this one too. We're joined by Mr. Claude Berube. He is from the United States Naval Academy. He's also currently serving the United States Naval Reserve, and we welcome him to the show now, and we're going to find out just a little bit about him. So first off, Claude, good morning, and thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. It's always good to drive into the Imperial City once in a while.
Yeah, to head into, you know, to head into the beehive, as it were. So as I mentioned, currently serving still in the Navy Reserves, but tell us just a little bit about yourself, where you're from, when you joined, and what you do in the Navy.
Sure. I grew up in New England, and I was a latecomer to the Navy. I thought I was going to go in around 88, 89, but we were doing a drawdown, and I found later, many years later, a direct commission program. So I came in as an intelligence officer, I think when I was the ripe age of 33.
Wow.
And been in since with a couple of minor IIR breaks, and it's been great. Served overseas with Expeditionary Strike Group 5. I was an intel officer on the Bunker Hill. Served at UCOM at Jack Molesworth. And all told, in the past 18 years, I think I've spent 8.5 years on active duty.
Not only as a naval officer, both on active duty and in the reserves, but you also instruct out at the Naval Academy, teaching our young officers.
I've been at the Academy for 12 years now. And prior to that, I worked at the Office of Naval Intelligence as a civilian. I worked on Capitol Hill a couple of times. And I worked as a contractor for Office of Naval Research. So kind of done a little bit of everything around the general area here.
When it comes to the Naval Academy and being there and seeing the young future officers of the Navy, those midshipmen, you see it every day as an instructor over there. How does it feel to be teaching the next generation of naval leaders, and are you confident in their ability to lead the Navy?
Well, I'll tell you, my first day teaching there in 2005, I almost actually got physically sick as I was about to enter the classroom, because I said to myself, you know, it's like 7:55 and I had to be there in 30 seconds. And all I could think of was, I saw Patriot Games with Harrison Ford. He's talking to all these midshipmen. They're really smart. What am I going to talk about for an hour and a quarter, much less an entire semester? Well, two things happened. I did walk into the classroom, but then I later learned that Patriot Games didn't use Naval Academy midshipmen. I think they used ROTC kids from GW. So they weren't as intimidating. But I got to tell you, this is the best job I have ever had in my life. These young men and women, I've taught about 1,200 of them now. They're from all around the country. I've taught kids who grew up on Park Avenue. I've taught a kid who escaped the gangs of East L.A., and they both turned out to be SWOs. These kids are just absolutely amazing, and they're creative. They're fun. They're smart. They're hardworking. And it really is a pleasure to, I haven't had a bad day in 12 and a half years over there.
That's
so when I look at the future of my Navy, you know, they're the ones who now inspire me. I'm, you know, I'm supposed to be inspiring them as an instructor, but they're truly the ones who drive me every day to do what I do and hope that I can impart some history geek information and especially in naval history.
And having seen Patriot games myself, I hope that the Irish don't come after you on the streets of Annapolis.
We actually, you know, I used to be the officer rep for the pipes and drums, and we got a couple of bagpipers, and we reshot that scene right outside of Gate 3. It was a lot of fun, and yeah.
It's a beautiful town down there, a beautiful campus. For those who haven't had the opportunity to visit it, I highly recommend it. And one of the great things about the Annapolis campus is the museum, the U.S. Naval Academy Museum. And that's what we're actually going to talk to you about today, because for all of the wonderful exhibits at the museum, it turned out that one of the most wonderful things about it was something they didn't even know that they had over there. And can you tell us about these flags that were recently found?
Sure. So keep in mind that the museum has responsibility for about 60,000 artifacts. We're the oldest Navy museum in the country. And we had flags stored, not stored, but they were displayed in a different building called Mahan. It's one of the oldest buildings on the yard. It's over 100 years old. And as part of a preservation project, these are trophy flags. So President Polk, back in 1849, said any flags captured by naval forces will go to the United States Naval Academy. So we have responsibility for now about 300 of those foreign flags. A lot of them came from the War of 1812, the Spanish-American War. But then there are some minor incidents comparatively. The Korean incident of 1871. There's a Chinese piracy expedition in 1854. So essentially, these War of 1812 trophy flags were displayed for more than 100 years behind cases we couldn't access. We actually had to finally get the money to cut them away to take the flags down. Well, behind those flags, there were sort of rumors that there were other flags behind them. But because it was 1913, you know, the records were a little screwy back then. Hmm. But also, you know, if anything was there, they may have deteriorated over time. So a couple of months ago, we finally cut the cases, the glass. We removed the War of 1812 British flags that were flying on the ships, and exposed were these pristine flags. You know, I was worried it was going to be like Geraldo Rivera and Al Capone's vault.
Al Capone's
vault. And open it up, nothing's there. But the Korean expedition, particularly, those flags were in the same condition that they were 50 years ago now. And these were, some of them were guidons. So, you know, you went through Great Lakes.
Yeah.
So you had a guidon, you know, standard, so that the company would know where to march to, et cetera. Or you see this now in Vikings. I don't know if you watched that series, but
my wife
series.
Has. I've watched some of it. Yeah, yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
they expose these. And so now we can then display them. We're going to store some of them. We're going to have a rotation now of displaying them. But that's an extraordinary thing. It's sort of like being a meteorologist during a blizzard or a hurricane. It's like, yeah, this is why you are head of the museum, because you get to see these things being exposed for the first time in over 100 years. And the extraordinary thing, midshipmen came from all over the yard just to watch the opening of these cases, but also subsequently what these things looked like. We kept them up in place for a few hours, and we're going to be opening up a few more cases as well.
It's amazing that these things can be there, and it sounds like they had maybe an idea that there was some stuff there. Mm-hmm. As you said, the Al Capone's vault worries. Yeah. Turned out that unlike what Geraldo ran into, you guys ran into a treasure trove here, including one that was taken from a Chinese pirate fort near Macau back in 1854. What were some of the most interesting flags to you as a history buff yourself when you came through? Were there any that stuck out?
No, that I'll tell you that that was the one that struck me. It's when you look at it, it's a square flag with an octagon, reddish with a number of Chinese markings. But this was an expedition in 1854 where Lieutenant George Henry Preble takes a small steamer. He works with the British, Portuguese, and some Chinese authorities to deal with Chinese pirates between Macau and Hong Kong. I mean, they were plentiful. They had fortresses, and he actually launches an expedition along with these. So as somebody who had been off of the Horn of Africa doing early anti-piracy stuff on a ship, you know, that particularly intrigued me. So I've got an article that's going to be coming out here in the next couple of weeks. So about that incident.
There's so much to be gathered from history. And I think in today's era where our Navy is so dominant on the seas, there's really you can say there's some competition, there's some threats to our Navy certainly out there, but overall, our Navy is number one by a long shot. These flags are a throwback to when things were a little bit more even as far as the playing field on the seas, I would say, and show that, you know, battle at sea was such a bigger part of warfare in days gone by. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, keep in mind, you know, people say, well, you know, what's the big deal about flags? Well, you know, flags are so ingrained in us. You know, as kids, we play capture the flag. In popular culture, you've got musicals like Les Mis, and what's behind that iconic image is a French Revolutionary flag. If you listen to Revolution's podcast, you know, every revolution starts off with a flag. Our history of flags is extraordinary as well. You know, in the military, you've got morning colors. You've got the flags that drape, you know, the caskets of those who gave the ultimate sacrifice. Flags are part of who we are because they symbolize something more. One of the most powerful ones we have is the British Royal Standard. It's the only royal standard that was ever captured in combat.
Wow.
And it happened in York, Canada, which was at that time the capital during the War of 1812. Well, we captured that flag, brought it to the United States. The following year, the British invaded and burned Washington. So it was a retribution. Mm. So that flag represents not only our ability to capture a foreign capital, but also one that has consequences against our own.
Truly fascinating stuff. We're speaking with Claude Barrabee, who's from the United States Naval Academy. He's an instructor there. He's an author, currently serving as a naval intelligence officer in the Navy Reserves, and also works with the Naval Academy Museum. And this, of course, a big story, got a lot of play. It was on Fox News, a lot of other places. But the Naval Academy Museum has a lot more than just these flags, doesn't it? What do you think is, beyond this, let's say the most interesting thing that you find about the Naval Academy Museum, or the thing that you think people would enjoy the most visiting?
A couple. I mean, of course, we have the more flags, like the Don't Give Up the Ship flag from the War of 1812. But our entire second deck are British dockyard models. These are 200 to 350 years old. We don't have as many as England does. These are the ones, these are the models that were built at the same time as the ships themselves.
Right.
So we know exactly what they look like on a scale level. So that helps me teach naval history from a very different perspective. And, you know, the same problems that the Royal Navy had 300 years ago, the same problems we're dealing with today, strategy, personnel, weapons, you know, you name it, naval architecture. So that is the best collection people will see outside of England. On the first deck, which is the history of the United States Navy, we've got everything from the original Mameluke sword, which becomes the basis of the United States Marine Corps sword, which was taken by a midshipman man during the Battle of Derna in the Tripoli War. You know, we've got our sword collection is probably second to none in terms of the Navy. We've got Stephen Decatur's presentation swords. We've got a number of items from the Monitor versus the Merrimack, the original wheel of the USS Hartford during the Battle of Mobile Bay, and so many. I'll tell you, we display about 1,400 items. I would recommend somebody take at least 2 hours to walk through the museum because there's that much material. And we also have a lot of material online on YouTube. We've got, if you go to USNA Museum, you'll see a history of the Navy and 100 objects from the Naval Academy Museum. And these are 4 to 10 minute vignettes. People can watch about a particular item in the context of that item.
You know, most museums that I'm aware of have a certain number of things on display and actually have more that's not on display than they have on display at any one time. So that kind of makes them, for one, a return visit destination where, you know, if you go to the if you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they have stuff that's on display now that's not going to be 6 months from now and things that aren't on display that are going to be. Is that the way that it works at the Naval Academy as well?
Absolutely. And we have a couple of rotating galleries. We're doing we've got one exhibit right now on World War One, commemorating 100 years.
Right.
And on November 11th of 2018, we will have a silent ceremony, just like the silencing of the guns 100 years ago. And then we're going to replace that with the history of Navy and space. We're working with the Naval Research Lab, but we're also going to do one on Philo McGiffin, one of my favorite graduates of the Naval Academy. Graduated 1882, had so many demerits that he couldn't get a commission. So he went to China, got a commission with them, helped found their Naval Academy, and ended up commanding, he was the first American to command a modern warship in battle in the Sino-Japanese War. And the story of Philo McGiffin is really extraordinary as well. So we're going to tell his story of Philo McGiffin in China. And we're going to be able to use things that we haven't seen in a while. And we do that with every exhibit. We actually tried to do it with our NavyCon, which was a Navies and Science Fiction one, but we didn't get quite that far. We just had the convention for a day. It was great.
One of the things about this story with the flags, the flags that were recently unearthed, that hadn't been seen in really about 100 years or so, that I wasn't expecting before you came in here, but hearing it about how the midshipmen came out to see this happen, I think that's one of the interesting things, where this is a museum that's also at a learning institution. And I think there are people out there who worry that the youth of today have no interest in history, that they don't think they can learn much from history. And to be honest, during my college experience, which was in my 30s, I saw a little bit of that. I saw a little bit of people saying, well, history's boring, I don't want to do this. It kind of warms my heart a little bit to hear that the middies at the academy anyway were very interested in this.
Yeah, well, we're a teaching museum, but it's also incumbent on us to expand the interest of the museum to the midshipmen, not just for naval history. For example, we were given a pair of Japanese field artillery glasses from the Battle of Iwo Jima, and I got a couple of physics majors to strap them on their back. They're 70 pounds. They took them up to the top, the highest actually, it was second highest place at the academy. And they put eye charts across the river. And based on elevation, distance, et cetera, they were able to reconstruct the capability of these particular field glasses. So they said the Japanese could see every Marine coming ashore at Iwo Jima. We have another project ongoing with chemistry majors where they're assessing the dyes and pigments and paint for some of our launching flags that were painted 200-300 years ago. So we're really trying to work more. We're working with the languages department. The midshipmen who are Russian majors, they've done Mandarin and Spanish. We now have a foreign language audio tour for 30 objects in the museum. So these are midshipmen who learned these languages at the academy. They translated this for us. They transcribed them for us. They recorded them. And so now somebody from Spain or Russia can pick up scan the QR code and listen to a midshipman speak their language that they learned at the Naval Academy. And the mids always come back and say, we didn't realize that, you know, being language majors or physics majors, we would be able to work with our naval heritage. So that's that's responsibility we have as well. So it's not just the midshipmen, it's us to make sure that they are intrigued and it is relevant to what they are doing. We had an event on damage control and leadership where we had the captains of the USS Samuel B. Roberts and the Cole come in and speak to the midshipmen about how do you deal with a crisis.
And those are important things, and a lot is being taught. And it sounds like you guys almost have a self-contained research unit down there as well with the middies contributing to the museum at the Naval Academy Museum. And we're speaking with Claude Barraby, who is from the Naval Academy. He's an instructor there. He's also a Naval Reserve Intelligence Officer and an author. And since we're on the subject of history, I wanted to ask you about one of your books in particular, and that's because I've been to the USS Constitution. I've been on board of it. I've actually slept at the old Marine Corps barracks up there one night. And the Constitution, of course, many people in the Navy and even outside of it know, is the oldest vessel still on the Navy rolls. It's still technically a commissioned warship. I know a little bit about the Constitution from having been there and visited it. But I think one of the interesting things that we forget about is that there were men who served on board the Constitution, and you wrote a book called A Call to the Sea about Captain Charles Stewart of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating to me to think about, like, this ship that's still there, people are still going on to it, everybody knows the Constitution. We don't know that much about those who served on board. So what can you tell us about Captain Stewart and what life was like aboard the Constitution?
Sure. That was the first of five books that I wrote, and I love Charles Stewart because nobody had written about him. He had a career that spanned from 1798 to 1860, so he had one of the longest careers in the Navy. He commanded more ships than anybody else in U.S. Navy history. He commanded the Constitution for a longer period during wartime, the War of 1812, than anybody else in American history. An extraordinary individual who had fought. He had his first command at 21 during the Quasi-War, fought during the Barbary War, but during he was an extraordinarily capable officer who was able to. For the sailors out there, one of the most difficult things you can do with a sailboat is back the ship. He backed the Constitution. He basically stopped and essentially, more or less, reversed course. And as one of the ships passed him by, just took another broadside. He took on two ships simultaneously. The only problem is that it was about a month and a half after the Treaty of Ghent had been signed. And they knew the Treaty of Ghent had been signed. They'd been advised of this off the African coast. But he continued to pursue British ships because he understood the Constitution document, not just the ship.
Right.
Because under the Constitution, he said, well, wait a minute. We're still fighting because the Treaty of Ghent has been signed, but the treaty has not been ratified by the Senate. So the war still continues for us. So here's a guy who understood
letter of the law.
The letter of the law. And Jefferson had mentioned that of him 10 years previously when he kept us out of a war.
Absolutely fascinating stuff. And when you look at the portrait on the cover of that book, just a fancy dresser too.
And it is here. Yeah, you think he's Napoleon when you. But
the stance and everything.
If you're in D.C., go to the National Gallery of Art. You will see that painting, and it is about 8 or 10 feet tall. It's incredible. I actually spent about an hour just looking at that, trying to evaluate it for the book.
And now all we do is take an 8x10 of our commanding officer and stick it on a photo book.
I want this. When I retire, you're responsible for this. You find an artist. I want a portrait. An oil painting in a bicorn and, you know, the epaulettes. That's what I want.
I want a fancier hat than that. I want like an 8-point hat. I want one that just looks, everybody who sees it will know. It'll have shiny things on it and everything. You know, there is so much to learn from history when it comes to people like Captain Stewart, when it comes to these flags that were recently unearthed at the Naval Academy. Museum. And looking at those specifically, Claude, do you think that there's anything besides just the cool factor to these mm-hmm. flags that people can take from actually going and seeing them or learning about where these flags came from?
Yeah, it's about understanding the context of the conflicts. B.J. Armstrong, Commander B.J. Armstrong of our Department of History, just wrote a great piece for War on the Rocks I would recommend about the Korean incident and the flags, because he provides the context. And then as Korea becomes in the more and more in the news, It provides some historical context that I think is very important. So it's not just the coolness of the flags themselves. Everybody has, it's like the Rorschach test.
Right.
You know, the conservators are like, well, how did they sew this? The historians will say, well, when was this captured and how? The political scientists will say, what does it mean? Hmm. Also with historians too, but.
Yeah.
So. There's something for everybody.
There is. And really, also some beauty. I mean, when we think of flags these days, there's mostly your geometric shapes, your stars, your stripes, your bars, different things on there. A lot of these had a little bit more artistry to them.
Yeah, I would suggest to all of you, go to the U.S. Naval Academy Museum Facebook page. Go back to early December, and you will see photos of a number of these flags, especially the Korean flags. The color is still there. You'll see the dragons.
Looking at that one right now.
Yeah.
This dragon with pink wings and the clouds around it are very artistic, and everything about those flags. They're crazy.
Right. And we brought in somebody who's an expert from the Languages and Cultures Department. And you'll see a couple of videos on our Facebook page from them discussing what the meaning was behind the flags themselves. What does the dragon connote? What are the other symbols? So you'll see that on our Facebook page as well. And she did that as we were unveiling these.
When it comes to flags that were captured from other nations, some of those nations could look at those as part of their history. Do you think there's any question about someone maybe trying to come and retrieve those flags?
Yeah, actually, South Korea had asked for a long time for the Generalissimo flag. It was the general's flag of 1871, and they do have it on long-term loan right now in Seoul. Mm. The Canadians have in the past asked for the British Royal Standard. Jimmy Carter was considering returning it in return for, hostages who came out of Iran.
Oh.
But, you know, you know, I hate to say finders keepers, but, you know, a lot of other countries have things that are ours as well.
Right.
So it's really, as long as we respect each other's heritage, we take care of these. I know the Canadians, the British take care of things that they have that were American. And we all work together. And that's the important story. You know, we're working with the Canadians and British right now on a couple of things. And, you know, time may not necessarily heal all wounds, but it helps us to understand each other and work together.
Right. And the museum communities are known for that. There's a lot of things that go on loan. There have been, who was the pharaoh that I remember when I was a kid? The exhibit was
King
traveling.
Tut.
There you go. King Tut was traveling around. It was in New York. I grew up outside of New York City, and it was there, and I got to go see that.
So you're educating people, and that's the thing. We're a public service. We're not just teaching midshipmen. Part of our responsibility as director of the Naval Academy Museum is to inform the general public on what the Navy has done for the past 200 plus years.
And doing a great job of teaching those midshipmen. And I know that because every Naval Academy graduate knows everything. As soon as they get out, they know everything that there is to know. Thanks to great instructors like Claude at Barabay, who is an instructor at the Naval Academy and is also currently serving as a reserve Naval intelligence officer, and is talking to us about these flags that were uncovered after almost 100 years. Do you think that there's a lesson to be learned, last question, for finding these things that you didn't know were there? Should museums be checking a little bit deeper when they look through their collections?
Yeah, I think that the larger lesson is the value of our collective heritage. You know, I look at places in the Middle East which have lost so much of their heritage out of conflict. You look at the libraries that have been destroyed. Yeah. You know, the preservation of our history and understanding ourselves is I think, paramount.
Yeah, you can look at places like Palmyra in Syria.
That's
where,
exactly.
The professor who was there, the archaeologist who basically was willing to give his life to try and protect these things and keep them secret. Thankfully, we don't have to deal with anything like that here. But there is still an onus on us to keep our heritage and our history alive, whether it comes to the military, whether it comes to our nation, or the world's finest Navy like they are over at the Naval Academy Museum. And we want to thank Claude Barraby for coming over here and talking to us about this morning, this wonderful find that they've made. And if people want to go and check it out, Claude, where should they go and how can they sign up to do that?
Go to the United States Naval Academy, bring your photo ID. We are open 362 days a year except Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, or find us on our website at the Naval Academy or Facebook. We post a lot of pieces there too.
A lot of great information there and a lot of great information here on the Morning Briefing. We want to thank Joe Schinelli of AmVets and of course Claude Barraby from coming in from the Naval Academy. Coming up tomorrow, we have Eric Mitchell from Life Flip Media and the VFW and a lot more. Tune in. See you then. Morning Briefing out.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.